It is Monday, June 10th, 2024, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Matthew Moore.
I'm Kyle Kellums. Today, Horseshoe Canyon Ranch is adding another sport to its activities list.
Because there are certain people involved that want to make sure that this is always going to be available to climbers for generations to come. And not just climbers now, it's for mountain bikers.
Plus, from Arkansas to publishing icon.
We say to the reader, look, honey, there's something you can do. You don't have to be a movie star or a television interviewer. You don't have to be a best-selling author. But there's something you can do good.
This week's archives from the Pryor Center focus on Helen Gurley Brown and romance novels and chocolate.
People already ask all the time, like, what's that smell? I'm like, it's the chocolate next door.
Two Friends Books and Markham & Fitz Chocolate in Bentonville combine forces. First, Sours News.
Support for KUAF comes from Essence Latin Dance, hosting their June Summer Social, June 15th, at World's Best Java and Pies in Springdale, starting with a cumbia class at 9 p.m. and the social from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. More information and registration at EssenceLatinDance.com.
This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, June 10th, 2024. I'm Matthew Moore. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF Public Radio, a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas. First up today, Horseshoe Canyon Ranch in Jasper has become a hub for outdoor adventure since it opened 27 years ago. But this year, the ranch is introducing some changes that have some patrons curious about its future. Most notably, the former Dude Ranch has replaced its riding horses with a fleet of electric mountain bikes. Ozarks at Large's Jack Travis takes us to Horseshoe Canyon for more.
As you crest the hill above Horseshoe Canyon, the ranch below looks the same as it has for almost 30 years. A dirt road leads cars through the valley's green slopes, climbers are scaling rocky bluffs that overlook the canyon, and a handful of cabins are filled with groups of families and friends. However, upon closer inspection, you might notice construction vehicles busy building trails for another new site, mountain bikes. Their presence may seem alarming, but the ranch's veteran adventure guide, Jason Roy, says he views the new bikes and trails as a sign of much-needed progress that will maintain the interests of all recreationalists who visit.
Because there are certain people involved that want to make sure that this is always going to be available to climbers for generations to come. And not just climbers now, it's for mountain bikers, you know. Outdoor recreation, there are certain people out there that have the capability of going out and buying their own island if they wanted to. They have unbelievable resources. Instead, they're putting their money back into the states where they came from, and that is pretty awesome.
Roy says that Horseshoe Canyon Ranch is changing. For example, horseback riding, a popular activity at the ranch, has been discontinued due to its costly nature. However, Horseshoe Canyon will remain a bastion for Arkansas rock climbing. The famed climbing competition, 24 Hours of Horseshoe Hell, will still occur every year. They're adding new events, like the Arkansas Climbers Festival, which took place earlier this year in March. Plus, the ranch will be the second stop for the Arkansas Graveler, a cross-state bike tour that's preparing for its first year. New attractions are appearing on the canyon walls, too. Roy says he and his crew are developing new climbing routes, both on smaller boulders and huge cliffs. But he's particularly excited about the installation of a European climbing activity called Via Ferratas.
It's Italian for Iron Way. All right, it's basically a climbing route that follows a permanent fixed cable that runs along the entirety of the route. And so when you're climbing that, you have a lanyard attached to your harness, and you have two different clips to clip onto the cable.
As you move along the course, you clip into the different cables that run along paths, one carabiner at a time. This way, there's never a time when you're disconnected.
So you have rebar that you're holding onto in some spots, like a ladder system. You have natural rock holds, you have aerial bridges. We have all of that. We even have like a cave section you can go through, and it has like a generator up there, fires up our lights. It's like going through a mine. It's really unique.
This assisted style of rock climbing allows for increased accessibility without sacrificing the thrill of outdoor climbing.
people also get, you know, a lot of exposure up there. So you're still at height. You're connected to that cable, but it's like you don't have to have a lot of climbing experience or strength. You don't have to be a very strong climber to go up there and enjoy that.
A lot of the added programming at Horseshoe Canyon prioritizes accessibility. Roy mentioned that the ranch recently changed ownership, and a lot of these changes are happening because of that sale. Jamie Chalmers, the ranch's general manager, says the original proprietor, Barry Johnson, pursued the new owners. The newcomers remain unnamed, but the ranch is now managed by Ropeswing Hospitality.
And anybody that does the research at the end of that will find out that we are Walton affiliated, but not Walmart affiliated.
Okay, tell me a little bit more about the distinction there.
Well, so the previous owners just had a vision for the ranch and wanted it to stay the same or similar to just being open to the public, providing outdoor recreation for people. And they sought out the owners that we have now because they knew they could carry on that just through the future and make it even more accessible to people. With the offer of the new, like, bike trails and things like that.
Walton affiliation, followed by new bike trails, is not an uncommon phenomenon in Northwest Arkansas. Bike program manager Andrew Onerma says accessibility has affected their decision-making process regarding cycling at the ranch. For example, they chose to provide e-mountain bikes for rental rather than standard analog cycles.
The terrain here is so steep and challenging that if someone were to want to rent out a bicycle, or if we're doing these bulk group trips, we found that the e-mount bike makes it a little bit more of a level playing field for everyone, lets them see more without being absolutely exhausted in the first, you know, 15 to 30 minutes.
E-bikes have developed a reputation for being bad for trails due to their increased speed and power their motors allow. Onerma says this isn't necessarily the case.
Really more so comes down to the property or the land that it's on. So I actually had a family visiting from Siloam Springs this past weekend. It was a family of six, husband, wife, and four kids, and they all had e-mountain bikes, and they were so excited they could come out here and ride. They've been in other areas like Moab where they say e-bikes are prohibited, and that comes more so with the BLM land or special relationships with landowners, property owners. And for Moab, for instance, the issue was the microbiome soil or whatever it's called.
He's talking about bioactive soil crust. In arid regions like Moab, Utah, the desert landscape is partially covered by a knobby black crust made up of living organisms like lichen, mosses, green algae, microfungi, and bacteria. If it's trampled, it can take years to recover. So to protect the fragile crust, Utah prohibits the use of e-mountain bikes on many trails. Onerma says that e-bikes and analog bikes have the same effect on the trail itself.
The thing is, everybody's supposed to stay on the same trail anyway. So the trails are actually the same. The trails we have here are the same. There's nothing that makes it an e-mountain bike trail or standard mountain bike trail. So you can ride either bike and have the same trail experience. It's sheerly just for the amount of vert we have here is really why we are running them out.
Climbers may also worry that the new trails will encroach upon the spaces previously dedicated to their sport. Onerma says he used to be a climber at Horseshoe Canyon Ranch and understands their anxieties. Since the trails are on private land, the team at Horseshoe Canyon can work closely with construction crews.
As far as, hey, we need to avoid certain climbing areas. We can't be getting too close with the mountain bike trails to where we're now in the way of where the belayers would be or where the crash pads are going. So just having the direct communication made that process a lot simpler versus causing problems down the road where, say, a trail crew comes in and does their own thing and is completely oblivious to the other activity groups. So it's nice that we can have that impact and be cautious with what we do.
Horseshoe Canyon is not the only property near Jasper to come under wealthy new ownership. Runway Group, a holding company founded by Tom and Stuart Walton, purchased three buildings on the downtown square in Kingston. Johnny Morris, founder of Bass Pro Shops, is developing the land that used to house Dogpatch USA into a private nature preserve. What's more, Runway Group also recently sought public opinion on changing the Buffalo National River's designation to a national park preserve. With much change in the air, only time will tell how Newton County's future plays out. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jack Travis.
Jack Travis produces his stories inside the Bruce and Ann Applegate News Studio 1. Still to come this hour, Helen Gurley Brown was born in Green Forest, grew up in Little Rock, and revolutionized magazine publishing.
I was 37, but I was no loser. I had a good job, and I had lots of men in my life. And he said, why don't you write about what it was like for you? And he said the same thing about sex and the office. He said, you had a good working life. You still have it.
Helen Gurley Brown and Pryor Center Archives ahead on today's Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. The world's largest cancer conference was held earlier this month in Chicago and brought together practitioners from around the world to present new research on cancer treatment and detection. Julie Grelow is the chief medical officer and vice president of the American Society of Clinical Oncology and says while the death rate from cancer in the U.S. is declining, the number of people diagnosed with some form of cancer is on the rise.
Colon cancer, we are seeing it increasingly diagnosed at younger ages, and we've actually decreased the age at which we're recommending colon cancer screening, and we're recommending it also be based on if you do have any colon cancer in your family.
Colon cancer is one of Arkansas's leading causes of cancer deaths at 20 per 100,000, just behind lung cancer. Grelow says cancer screenings are the most important part of prevention and treatment, but getting people to take that step is often the biggest barrier. She says that's where new technology could help.
Can we use artificial intelligence to get people to come in for their colon cancer screening? And there was a study in inner city New York that looked at a bot, and she called patients who had been referred for colonoscopy screening for colon cancer and who had missed their appointments. And she could have a back and forth talking about why it's important to get your colonoscopy, what it involves, why didn't you come in, what were you nervous about explaining it. And also she could speak Spanish, by the way. And they were able to double the rates of people who they got in for colonoscopy after using this artificial intelligence, this bot, to help better explain and spend more time with patients, because we've got to figure out how we can really respond to the patients and what their concerns are, what the barriers are, and help with that. I loved that abstract.
She says the field of oncology is advancing in treatment options and patient care, which she believes will lead to better quality of life and health outcomes for people diagnosed with cancer.
It's not just chemotherapy anymore. There are lots of cancers now that we are treating without chemo, but with targeted therapies, immunotherapies, et cetera. So I have a lot of hope that's come out of this. I think we have better ways of supporting our patients through telemedicine, as we talked about. And I see a very bright future. I see a lot of advancements that have come out of this meeting. And I'm looking forward over the next couple of years to doing even better in helping our patients with cancer.
You can find information about cancer screenings, treatment, and research at cancer.org.
We say to the reader, look, honey, there's something you can do. You don't have to be a movie star or a television interviewer. You don't have to be a best-selling author. But there's something you can do good. Let's find out what it is.
Welcome back, Randy Dixon, with the Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History.
It's great to be back. I've missed you.
I've missed you. We've had a couple of archives the last 2 weeks, but this is new, and who did we just hear?
Oh, man, that is Helen Gurley Brown, and she was sort of giving her philosophy of women, of life. And the reason we are talking about Ms. Brown today is that she was an author.
Yes.
Publisher.
Yes.
Businesswoman, also from Arkansas.
And actually born not too far from where you and I are sitting.
Green Forest,
yeah,
in Carroll County. But early in her life, moved to Little Rock. Her father was a legislator and was later appointed to the Game and Fish Commission as the commissioner. In a really bizarre accident, he was killed at the state capitol in an elevator mishap. Mm. And she was only 10 years old, so this would have been 1932.
Wow.
And sort of left, you know, the family, of course, without a husband or father, but also in kind of financial straits. So before we get into all of her accomplishments, you know, she was known for being the publisher and editor-in-chief of Cosmopolitan magazine, gosh, from 1965 to 1997.
And that's when Cosmo was really a trendsetter, a vanguard, really, in
absolutely
publishing.
It was the magazine to emulate.
Yes.
She set the standard for any type of magazine, really, whether it was for men or
right.
women or anything in general. But we at KATV had a chance to talk to her. She died in 2012, but in 2005, our reporter, who's now the main anchor at KATV, Beth Hunt, and our photographer, Tim Hamilton, who just retired as a professor from Harding, mm-hmm. And I went to New York into her beautiful penthouse on Central Park West. She and her husband had a penthouse. There were two towers on this beautiful building, and she had one of them. And her neighbor on the other side of the building was John McEnroe.
Wow.
So,
and it overlooked Central Park?
Oh, right across the street, 81st and Central Park West.
Oh, my gosh.
I think it was called the Beresford Building. But we had a chance to sit down and talk to her. And Beth, of course, asked her about growing up in Arkansas.
Growing up in Little Rock had its challenges because of no money and no daddy. But I did well in school. I was kind of popular. I always had a boyfriend. So the point here is that I had wonderful girlfriends, and I was a little achiever. I think from about age 6, my mother said to me, "Helen, use your brain." Well, mothers didn't say that to little girls in those days. She kind of encouraged me to be smart. So I got wonderful grades. Growing up in Little Rock is the best thing I ever did because the values were good, and I learned to become who I became.
What she became was a cultural icon.
No doubt about it. No doubt about it.
For decades.
Yeah.
But it didn't come easy. It came to her actually later in her life. So I guess we still have a chance, Kyle.
Okay. All right.
All right. So to better tell her story, I enlisted the help of an expert on Ms. Brown. Her name is Dr. Jennifer Scanlon. She's a professor and of gender studies. She's also a vice president and dean at Bowdoin College in Maine. She wrote a book in 2010 entitled "Bad Girls Go Everywhere," which is from a quote from Helen Gurley Brown that she was once said, "Good girls go to heaven, but bad girls go everywhere." So Scanlon's realized that there had never been a book written about Helen Gurley Brown and was fascinated by her. She started going through her papers and then got to meet her and did several interviews with her, got to know her and her husband. And here's what she had to say.
Her early life as a working woman, that was just central to her development as a person. up, I think, Arkansas, learning more about her childhood or just the ways that she talked about it were important. You know, there's sort of the emphasis, again, in a conversation that might be different than something that's on the page.
Before Cosmopolitan, I mean, she had to... She was in sort of the magazine advertising world?
Well, yes. She went to college, got a degree, and went into secretarial work, which, you know, in the 1950s, that's what a lot of women did. And she worked at advertising agencies, talent agencies, I can imagine, like Mad Men.
Yeah.
But it was out in California. She had moved from Little Rock. I think they lived in Georgia for a little while and then moved out to California, and that's where she started her career and worked on that for years, but soon rose to be a copywriter and was very successful. At one point, she was one of the highest paid copywriters in the country. But in 1959, this is where a lot changed. She married a journalist and magazine editor named David Brown, who encouraged her to kind of go beyond what she was doing. And she asked him, I want to write a book. What should I write about? And he told her that he found her to be the most unique and fascinating single woman that he had ever known. And he said, you know, why don't you write about that? And, well, the result was nothing short of phenomenal.
I talked to my girlfriends at the agency, and I just wrote this little book about our life as single women. And I was already 37 years old before I got married. You're supposed to be married when you're 19. And I wrote about being single, the fact it was okay to be single. You didn't have to have a husband. You might have somebody else's husband occasionally, but you didn't have to have your own husband. And then I said that if you were having sex, don't be ashamed. You don't have to tell anybody about it. And use birth control, of course. But enjoy yourself. Sex is wonderful. I've always said it's one of the three best things there are, and I don't know what are the other two. So I wrote that. We found a small, obscure publisher in New York who published the book, Sex and a Single Girl. And I'm getting so much mail from women who thought they had a new best friend. They never heard anybody tell them before that they could be single and have sex. They could be single and be respectable.
It was a bestseller.
Yes.
It created waves in so many varieties of ways. I argue that, you know, that influenced heavily Carrie Bradshaw in Sex and the City.
Yes. I mean, the title was Sex and the Single Girl.
Right.
And now think about it. This was 1962.
62, right.
And people weren't talking about sex.
Oh, you wouldn't.
Especially
I don't think the word
as
sex
as frankly
in the title.
As she did. And this book was so popular, it was translated and published in 28 countries and stayed on the bestseller list for more than a year. So now she was getting to be well known. There was even a 1964 movie that was, I guess you would say, loosely based.
Inspired by?
Yeah, there you go.
You know what it was? It was inspired by the title.
Yes, exactly.
That's it.
And that was the title of the movie. But get this. It had Henry Fonda.
Oscar winner.
Lauren Bacall.
Oscar winner.
Tony Curtis.
Oscar nominee.
And guess who played Helen Gurley Brown in the movie?
Brown eyes and all.
Natalie Wood. Here's a little bit of the trailer.
Sex and the Single Girl, that titillating bestseller by Helen Gurley Brown. And the inspiration for a hilarious new motion picture.
Mention sex, and the single girl will blush a lot. Though she wrecks every single guy with what she's got.
So it was this madcap comedy that, you know, combined all the elements at the time, but it was, you know, it was pretty racy.
And it was popular.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, it was a big box office success. So that led to another book, Sex, of course.
Right.
This was Sex in the Office. So I was, in doing the research, I found a 1964 interview from the Walter J. Brown Media Archives, and this is where she's been being interviewed about the second book coming out.
There are two reference books that are a must for every secretary nowadays. In addition to the usual secretarial handbook, we now have Helen Gurley Brown's Sex and the Single Girl. Ms. Brown has now written a new one, Sex in the Office. Ms. Brown, what inspired you to write these books?
My husband thought of the idea for both of them. He thought I was kind of an exemplary single woman because I was 37, but I was no loser. I had a good job, and I had lots of men in my life. And he said, why don't you write about what it was like for you? And he said the same thing about Sex and the Office. He said, you had a good working life. You still have it. And why don't you encourage girls who work for a living and tell them not to be so sorry for themselves? They can find men at the office. They can have a great time.
Yeah, everything about that sounds 1964, the way the questions are asked. And yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it was probably unusual for a woman to be conducting the interview. You know, a little later, we're going to hear her on some talk shows, and it kind of made me mad at some of these insulting, really. I think they were trying to be funny, but it really made me feel uncomfortable because they were making fun of her. I think I even remember hearing one man refer to her as a dingbat.
What?
I mean, right to her face. But what was great is that she handled all of this controversy and all this, you know, poking at her with such grace and elegance. And she would handle these, I guess you'd call them chauvinistic.
They sound like Will Ferrell from Anchorman.
Oh, easily.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Multiply that times about 10. But
But we haven't gotten to Cosmopolitan yet.
No.
She's already been a successful author twice over. She's become a mainstay in popular culture.
And get this.
We haven't gotten to the magazine.
She's 40. She's pushing 40. She didn't even get married until she was 37. So she had full career and, you know, a life as a single person. So she spoke from experience and was successful at it. So all right, let's get into Cosmo Magazine.
All right.
You know, the idea, you know, she said that she was getting these letters from people. The other book comes out, and she's just getting flooded with letters. And, you know, the magazine idea kind of sprang out of that. And, again, she credits her husband with this idea.
So I'm getting all this mail. I'm answering it every night. And David said, you had a magazine you could answer everybody at one time. We didn't know any better. We just sat down at the kitchen table, did up a little format kind of based on the book. He took it all over New York. Nobody wanted to start a magazine, but he got to the Hearst Corporation, where they had a once illustrious magazine that's now hemorrhaging, it's falling apart. They're losing so much money, they're going to fold it. They said, well, she can try her format on the magazine. We'll give her a year. It worked immediately. The first issue sold 90% of its print order. Most magazines sell 35 or 40. It was an instant success. It went on to be in the top 10 selling magazines in the country, and there are 40,000 magazines published, and we became the number one magazine at college campus bookstores because I had good common sense.
All right, so Cosmopolitan had existed, I think, since the 20s.
Yes.
But it was fledgling.
It had been around for a long time.
You know, it was kind of going
away. Husband had actually been an editor for the magazine years and years before, and when it was just not successful at all.
Well, it was going the route of Saturday Evening Post.
Yes.
It was kind of dying.
Well, yeah, and it didn't do it as well.
Yeah.
So she came in and turned it on its ear. Actually turned everything on its ear. I asked Jennifer Scanlon about Brown's effect on Cosmopolitan and more.
You know, she had this enormous impact on Cosmopolitan magazine, which had been a venerable magazine around, you know, for nearly 100 years. And she had a very different idea for it, and she put her stamp on it. And, you know, it sexualized women again in ways that made lots and lots of people uncomfortable. But other people found it liberating, and she argued that it recognized women as, you know, more complete and comprehensive human beings. So she had a huge impact on women's magazines. You know, pretty soon after she took over Cosmopolitan, it became the magazine to emulate, and also it just made so much money. You know, people said that the Hearst building in New York, their new building, which is a spectacular building, was, they were able to build that building because of the money that she made on Cosmopolitan. And then, of course, there were international editions all around the world, you know, in many, many languages. So hers was a message that had significant global reach.
You know, her ideas were controversial in many different ways. But like we had said earlier, she was on the talk show circuit. And, you know, at the time, it was interesting to have her on the show. It was entertaining. Mm-hmm. It was a little controversial.
She's incredibly intelligent. She's glib. She's a great guest.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so Dick Cavett used to have her on. This is a 1970 episode of his show, and he asks her opinion about the National Organization for Women, which was very new, and the feminist movement that was kind of sweeping the nation.
Does this women's liberation movement bug you at all, these ladies who are out militantly asking to be recognized as people rather than just ladies? And
I have a feeling it bugs you. It doesn't bug me. In the beginning, actually, I was sort of uppity about the whole thing. When NOW was formed, Betty Friedan's organization.
Yeah. She wrote The Feminine Mystique. Is that
Yes,
Betty?
And it's a fabulous book, and I think she's a wonderful lady. But when the organization formed, I thought, oh, my word, you know, men aren't the problem with whatever it is that's the matter with us. I don't want to be hostile toward men and say that they're keeping us back, because nobody ever kept me back, I don't think. So I didn't join up with the movement because I thought they were blaming the whole thing on men. But now yeah. that it's gained some momentum in the last few months, I'm really kind of for them, because, you know, they want equal pay for women, and they want child care centers for young mothers, mm-hmm. and they want equal opportunities for girls, and there's something that, to say for all that. So I don't like their anti-male attitude, the ones who are really hostile, but basically their concepts are pretty good.
It takes her about 2 seconds to just take complete control. After he asks the question, she goes, well, I can tell you probably have a problem with this.
Exactly.
I just love how she disarms. You know, Cavett had a reputation for being this intellectual sort of haughty
yes.
interviewer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, at one point in the interview, she called him antediluvian.
Yes.
It's like, you know, take that, Dick.
Yes.
So I wanted to get back with Dr. Scanlon and talk to her about, you know, Brown's critics. And it was interesting that she pointed out that, you know, the attacks that she got were from more than one direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say she had two sets of critics. One was, you know, conservative people who felt that she was salacious, right, or that they really bristled at the sort of frankness with which she talked about sex, the frankness with which she talked about the ways that, you know, men paid for things with their wallets and women paid for things with their bodies. She was very direct about the ways that sexual commerce operated in people's lives. So there were a lot of people who were very uncomfortable with that on the conservative side. And I would say she also was really disliked by the feminists at that time, who felt that she was not pointing sufficiently to women's independence, that she thought it was okay that women relied on men to buy things for them rather than pushed for full independence. And of course, to each of those categories of people, she said, well, I'm a realist, and you know, I see the way things are, and I don't think they're going to change overnight. So here are my solutions. And her messages worked for a lot of women.
I kind of want to close on what I consider just a great story. And this was at the very end of the interview as we were starting to kind of pack up. We were doing what you call, you know, set up, where you're just kind of shooting pictures. But she was telling Beth about getting her husband to marry her. And I thought this was very interesting because she could still play a game and use her womanly wiles.
I got very serious and said, I really think we should set a date. And he said, no. He said that we were doing fine, that he was faithful to me, he loved me, and he said he'd been married twice before. And that night, I said to him, I love you, and I'll miss you. You've been married twice before, but I haven't been married once before, and I don't want to hear from you again until you're calling up to set a date. And the thing about this system, Beth, is that it works, but you've got to be very strong, because they always call up and say, oh, can we talk this over? It means they want to come over and get into bed, you know, because you've got the hook in pretty far, but you can't let them come over. You can't have lunch. You can't do anything. The next telephone call has to be, but I want to get married. And finally, the phone rang one day, and I picked it up, and he said something very romantic. He said, okay, you win.
So she won.
Yeah.
She did win, and I tell you what, they were married for 51 years until his death in 2010.
Wow. You know, you think about Helen Gurley Brown, and then add to that John Johnson, who founded Ebony and Jet and was from Arkansas.
Yep.
I mean, you had Arkansans in the 60s and 70s really selling a lot of magazines and really, really influencing America.
Well, and that's when magazines
King
were it.
Yeah.
You know, you would get your subscription to whether it was Cosmopolitan or Jet or Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
And that's how you got your your entertainment way before the internet.
Right.
And that sort of thing. But, you know, I think a lot of people thought that Brown was either a hypocrite or sort of a contradiction of what was going on with women at the time, because you had, you know, the feminist movement that thought she was kind of pandering to men and knuckling under. Mm-hmm. But I liked what Dr. Scanlon said. She said she was a realist.
Yeah.
I mean, she is in a world that's male-dominated, and you have to manipulate. People manipulate every day.
Right.
And she knew how to play the system. She was also known for her letters.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I have saved a beautiful letter she wrote to me on Cosmopolitan letterhead. And it was beautifully written. And she, you know, signed a book to me. So
that's cool.
That was very nice.
You can find out so much about Arkansas history at the Pryor Center's website. Just put Pryor Center into a search engine. We're going to do this again next week.
I'll be here.
Thank you, Randy.
Mention sex, and the single girl will blush a lot, though she wrecks every single guy with what she's got.
Few things go better together than chocolate and romance. That's certainly what the owners of Two Friends Books and Markham & Fitz Chocolate in Bentonville are banking on. Starting tomorrow, they're pairing up to host Summer Nights with Books and Chocolate. Lauren Blanco is the owner of Markham & Fitz Chocolate. Monica Diodati is one of the owners of Two Friends Books. And we spoke over Zoom late last week to discuss the summer lineup. Monica says it seemed like a no-brainer kind of partnership, considering the two businesses share a wall.
Yeah, we can already smell the chocolate like wafting through the bookstore. So people already ask all the time, like, what's that smell? I'm like, it's the chocolate next door.
Lauren says the idea of the summer series came when a book publisher reached out with the idea of pairing books with chocolate.
And so we kind of ran with it and are working with them this summer on promotions. And we wanted to kind of bridge the gap between that and local partnerships. So we were just really inspired by the book and chocolate pairing and reached out to two friends and wanted to make something of our own together.
Monica says it works out great because they already had a romance book club running through their bookstore.
We kind of piggybacked on the picks for the romance book club that were already in place.
The book club sticks tightly to the boundaries of the genre.
So it does have to have like a happily ever after ending and not anything that like loosely fits a love story. It's like, no, this is romance. It's all about love and you're going to guarantee that like they get together at the end. So I think it kind of draws people who, just kind of appreciate a good story, want to feel good. And maybe from our other book clubs that might get a little more serious, this one already always feels like lighthearted and just good vibes all around.
The book club and chocolate pairing events are happening all summer. But the first event is beginning tomorrow night at 6, starting first at Two Friends. Monica says the book this month is Don't Want You Like a Best Friend by Emily Albin.
It is a queer Victorian romance. I just heard it described as gay Bridgerton meets The Parent Trap. But basically, there are these two young debutantes trying to set up their parents and end up like catching feelings for each other in the process.
When you hear the description, gay Bridgerton meets Parent Trap, how do you come up with a pairing for that?
That's a great question. I think, you know, when you're pairing such kind of different things like books and chocolate, it can be random. Or in this case, I felt like, you know, it was described to me as a queer romance. And I was like, well, we kind of have a queer white chocolate. It doesn't follow the rules of white chocolate. We use a goat milk instead of a traditional cow's milk. It's kind of tangy and different. And so that, I mean, that was kind of the inspo for choosing the orange creamsicle.
Lauren says at 7 o'clock, their shop will host the after hours chocolate pairing just next door to the bookstore. A secret drink menu will be available to members of the book club in addition to the pairing of the white chocolate orange creamsicle.
Our pairing menu is more ongoing because it's stuff we carry all the time. And so it's kind of open to anybody that, you know, shops at Two Friends for these books, but maybe misses the book club. They can come in and say, oh, what did you pair this book with? Can we get the orange creamsicle bar, which we paired with this particular book?
All of the pairings will be announced on social media and their website. But for those looking to get ahead on their reading for July, the pick will be Funny Story by Emily Henry. And August will be A Heart of Blood and Ashes by Mila Vane. And Lauren says a QR code will be available with more details on the pairings.
It'll link to both the secret drink menu and also you can scroll down to the next page and see all of the book and chocolate pairings for the summer. So if you're switching it up or sticking to your own schedule, you can still do the book and chocolate pairings on your own time.
You can find details about Summer Nights with Books and Chocolate at OzarksAtLarge.com.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas Songs. The Ozark Mountain Daredevils helped craft the country roots rock sound of the 1970s, and the Springfield, Missouri-based group was created around the sound of an Arkansaser from the flat delta land of the southeast. John Dillon of Stuttgart was the only original member of the Ozark Mountain Daredevils who was playing professionally. and that was at a Springfield pizza parlor which drew students from Southwest Missouri State University. Dylan, who played guitar, mandolin, and dulcimer, showed local poet Steve Cash, another future daredevil, how to play harmonica. The Arkansas Countian said he taught Cash harmonica the same way his own mother had taught him, telling him to carry the instrument with him always. Oh, country girl. John Dylan also organized a weekly jam in a local theater when his friend Larry Lee, who played guitar, piano, and drums, became bartender. Other area musicians like pianist Buddy Brayfield, guitarist Randall Chowning, and bassist Michael Soup Granda, who sometimes wore a Superman costume, all learned each other's songs, but the future Ozark Mountain Daredevils reportedly didn't even consider themselves an actual band. The owner of the theater where the musicians played thought otherwise. He worked to get a live tape of the group to music impresario John Hammond, who financed a demo. A staff producer for A&M Records and Glenn Johns, who had produced the debut of the Eagles, both flew to Missouri to hear the musicians in concert, but under pressure, the band faltered in performance. Afterwards, the producers were convinced to hear a post-gig acoustic performance, and the down-home version of Standing on the Rock by Stuttgart's John Dylan sealed the deal with a major label. A year and a half after first playing together, the musicians, which surely thought of themselves as a real band by now, were recording their debut in London, England. The band's debut album, The Ozark Mountain Daredevils, reflected the group's new name, shortened from Cosmic Corncob and His Amazing Ozark Mountain Daredevils. The band found chart success quickly. If You Want to Get to Heaven, heard here and written by Arkansas-er Dylan and Missourian Steve Cash, hit the top 25 in 1974. It remains a rock radio staple. But the biggest hit for the Ozark Mountain Daredevils came from their second album, It'll Shine When It Shines, named for another Dylan Cash composition. Although the album was recorded back home in Missouri, the album's true hit was a departure from the band's rootsy sound. Jackie Blue hit number 3 in early 1975 with a falsetto vocal and a modern pop sheen. Although the group was reluctant to leave Springfield, the Ozark Mountain Daredevils began to tour the world, and with some of the biggest names of the 1970s, Chicago, the Doobie Brothers, the Eagles, and others. The Ozark Mountain Daredevils continued performing and releasing albums through the 1970s. Dylan's Keep On Churning, heard here, is from the Daredevils' 1975 album, The Car Over the Lake. In 1977, theater owner Steve Canaday, who had cajoled John Hammond into hearing live tapes of the band in the first place, joined the group as the original lineup shifted. In 1978, Dylan and Cash appeared on a concept album about the American Civil War called White Mansions, with Waylon Jennings, Eric Clapton, and others. Skin train, running all day. Skin train, running all day. In 1980, the Ozark Mountain Daredevils switched to the label CBS for one unsuccessful album, and the group began to peter out and focus on solo projects. In the late 1980s, the Ozark Mountain Daredevils began performing and recording again and found an audience demand overseas. In 2000, A&M Records released a 21-track best of called Time Warp. In 2002, the band's long out-of-print catalog began to be reissued, with its third and fourth albums being released on CD. The Ozark Mountain Daredevils have never matched their early successes, but the nucleus of the original band, Missourian Steve Cash and Mike Granda, and Arkansas-er John Dylan, remain together into the 21st century. Here's the title track from the 1974 second album from the Ozark Mountain Daredevils, It'll Shine When It Shines, co-written by Stuttgart, Arkansas's John Dylan.
The old cat on the roof, he could stand a little push, 'cause he's got 9 good lives to live. But like my mama said, you only live till you're dead.
and you got to give and give and give. There's a pebble in the pond, going on and on, making waves and tides and ripples and rings. There's a leaf in the wind, they don't know where to end, chasing days and ways and wishes and dreams. Seems like everyone is out looking for the sun, singing rain and pain on he who hesitates. But it'll shine when it shines. You might think I'm wasting time, but I'm just a good old boy that's learned. Yes, I'm just a good old boy that's learned the way.
It'll Shine When It Shines from the 1974 second album by the Ozark Mountain Daredevils, co-written by Stuttgart, Arkansas's John Dillon. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with ArkanSongs.
Arkansas Arts Council bringing Arkansas performers and audiences together through its Arts on Tour grant. Learn more at ArkansasArts.org.
Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, the Arkansas Economic Development Commission is working with small businesses across the state to provide matching grants to improve innovation research.
So as a business, if you have applied for a federal SBIR grant, then the state, if you apply, it can match the SBIR grant one or two.
That's on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large.
You're listening to I Could Cry, an Abbott 45 from 1953. And you're on The Soundbeat.
I could cry 'cause I fell in love with you. I could cry 'cause you never could be true.
Gentleman Jim Reeves had 51 top 10 hits in a career cut short when a small plane he was piloting crashed in 1964. For your next morbid trivia night, he was taught by the same man who taught Randy Hughes, Patsy Cline's pilot, who, of course, had met the same fate a year earlier. But Reeves's records kept on coming. RCA Victor continued releasing unpublished songs, mixed with previously released tracks, and people kept buying them. Of those 51 top 10 hits we mentioned, 19 came posthumously. And there was a Jim Reeves single on the charts every year from 1970 to 1984, nearly two decades after his death.
For you, I could cry 'cause I'm still.
Check out more episodes right now at soundbeat.org. Soundbeat is produced at the Belfer Audio Archive, Syracuse University Library. I'm Brett Barry.
Ozarks at Large is a production of 91.3 KUAF Fayetteville. Contributors to today's show included Jack Travis, Daniel Carruth, Randy Dixon, and Stephen Cook.
Matthew produced today's show inside the Bruce and Ann Applegate News Studio today. I want to end today with some. A couple weeks ago, I was on vacation with my wife at Topsail State Park in Florida. One night, I heard these sounds. I don't know if it's birds, frogs, insects, or a chorus of each.
Yeah, we've got some creatures here.
And the other thing is, when you, and I did this with my phone, I didn't take my equipment with me, but you're listening and you realize just how much industry noise there is.
I love it.
Yeah. All right. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Matthew Moore. Be well.
Best Friends Animal Society will host the Super Adoption Event June 15th and 16th, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. daily at the Best Friends Pet Resource Center. It will include hundreds of adoptable dogs and cats from shelters and rescues around the region. More information at bfas.org/NWASuper.